Next month, in the suburbs of Boston, they'll be marking the 250th anniversary of the first shots fired in the American Revolution, a revolution that would beget a constitution with a system of checks and balances that's inspired not only other nations, but even common rules for peaceful global interaction. Will that system now bend or break? After all, it's neither the first nor the last time the White House has tested its limits. Or is Donald Trump taking the world's most powerful nation into uncharted territory? We'll ask about his bid to take that Silicon Valley adage to Washington, move fast and break things, fast enough to overwhelm a judicial branch of government that's struggling to keep up with his flurry of executive orders, what we call here decrees. What to make of the attack on judges and lawyers, the attempt to gut vast swathes of the government and shut down even public broadcasting? And do Americans mind this new turn? After all, a majority voted for Trump despite the attempt to overturn by force his defeat 4 years ago. Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about Trump pushing the powers of the U.S. presidency. With us, he teaches at an institution that's even older than the American Revolution, one targeted right now by the Trump administration, it seems. Bernard Harcourt, professor of law and political science at Columbia University in New York, author of The Counter-Revolution, How Our Government Went to War Against Its Own Citizens. Welcome back.
Thank you, François. Good to see you.
Welcome back as well to Philip Gollan, professor of political philosophy and international relations at the American University of Paris, the author of Power, Profit, and Prestige, A History of American Imperial Expansion. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
And since her remit is coping with a move fast and break things world, Reina Stamboliska is the CEO of digital consultants RS Strategy is with us as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You can, by the way, listen. That's right. Listen to the show and subscribe and like it wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah, the legislative opposition had seemed muted since Inauguration Day in Washington, perhaps until now. Democratic lawmakers for a second day displaying key parts from a top-level group chat on the messaging app Signal, one that mistakenly included the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine. Jeffrey Goldberg was shocked to be included, shocked that preparations for bombing the Houthis in Yemen earlier this month seemed so casual. National Security Council Chief Mike Waltz employing emojis. And since the Trump administration insists there's nothing classified in that group chat, Goldberg's followed up by publishing the part where Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spells out the bombing pattern. Trump's team shrugging off opposition calls to resign.
I'll say this. After 25 years in the Navy, you know, flying off of ships and as a test pilot, if you were sharing classified information in this manner, you would be fired. There would be an investigation. You could even be subject to a court-martial for this level of carelessness and incompetence.
So, Reina Stamboliska, totally not classified. What is there a level of, what does this exchange tell us about? Does it tell us just that, you know, there was an element of carelessness, or does it tell us something deeper about where U.S. democracy stands at this point?
I would go with both. You know, why choose when it can be both? So there are different hypotheses you could make around why that sort of conversation ended on Signal, which is, again, a commercial product, you know, digital messaging app. I have a lot of speculation, you know, hypothesis on this. It might be related to the recent Salt Typhoon hack of U.S. telco providers, which has been acknowledged to also concern the Department of Defense infrastructures that uses them. So you could imagine, okay, it's probable that they decided not to peruse those systems and to go and stick to something that's more secure, right? Oh, albeit it being commercially available, meaning unsanctioned for the type of conversation that was had there. Another, you know, plausibility, if you like, could be that it's a way of non-archiving communication, if you want, which is something Project 2025, you know, this Heritage Foundation flagship.
This roadmap that they set out last year for.
Right. They were even having, as far as I remember, videos, you know, tutoring about how to do non-archivable communication, government communication, right? So there are a lot of hypotheses and speculations. And my guess is it's a mixture of everything, especially given that the current administration considers rules, as we know them, to be a pile of BS, excuse my French, you know, to be bureaucracy, meaning something to be disposed of as soon as possible. And so it's incredibly difficult to say and to decide what to think of it in terms of why they did it, because you just can't trust them with anything, right? I mean, it could be a pure ignorance.
The Donald Trump's envoy for Ukraine in the Middle East was actually at the Kremlin.
In Russia, yeah.
So does that mean the Russians were probably...
That's speculation, and I'm like quite careful about, you know, diving into this, because there is enough food, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt around. So I'm kind of trying not to nurture it, you know, obviously the Russians have hacked it.
Right.
You know, but again, there is a situation where checks and balances are non-existent. I mean, and you said it in the introduction, right? The judicial system struggles with this. So regardless of what the main motivation was, we are left with an utter amount of carelessness here. For the time being, there is no, let's say, human loss on the U.S. side. However, what we've seen and what I read between the lines in the screenshots that The Atlantic published earlier today, is that they have planned bombing civilian residential buildings, right? Which is with such a nonchalance, you see it in the chat, you know.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, so there are a bunch of people sitting on a private chat and discussing how to insult Europeans as being freeloaders, and then casually discussing how to bomb a civilian, like a residential building, and that it all went great. And with emojis, fire, and, you know, and that sort of mercantile, weird thing is what makes the whole setup, in the sense of the makeup of this situation, very complex to read through.
In his first term, Donald Trump, people said, oh, it's... rule by tweets. Now it's rule by emojis, Philip Golub. Is it just kind of governing as entertainment?
Well, I think the emojis, I want to come back to what you were saying about the destruction of a civilian building. The emojis are obscene. You look at the Atlantic transcript and you know, so Hegseth is saying, well, you know, This has just happened. And then suddenly they have the emojis with fire burning and so on. It's really quite obscene that, you know, their complete lack of consideration. We knew this of them, of course. Their complete lack of consideration of human life and of what actually the contents of the policy that they are implementing. What is the policy that they were implementing there? That the United States is going to engage now in large-scale continuous bombings of Yemen because of the Houthis? The Houthis do not represent an existential threat to the international order. They do represent a problem for international trade routes, maritime routes. But they don't. Certainly the United States should not be engaging right now in large-scale transcontinental bombing campaigns simply because the president of the United States feels that he shows that he's a masculine and powerful leader, which he's actually not.
Bernard Harcourt, end result, second day of hearings, a grilling, sometimes a bit of squirming from the CIA director and others. But at the end of the day, is this actually a story about impunity?
It is. I don't think much is going to happen. But I also wonder how those emojis and how those texts are actually playing in the American imagination. And I'm not sure. And again, so I haven't watched Fox News to see how they're reporting on it. But I can imagine a way in which, you know, these emojis and the American flag and the, you know, fist pump and the strong arms and whatnot actually could be well received by a lot of Trump supporters, right? And also the stuff about Europe, right? That, you know, there's a way in which you've gone into the hidden side of Hegseth and others,
and the defense secretary,
you know, the defense secretary, and you've seen kind of how they're thinking and what they're thinking. And I think for many supporters of Trump, they're going to find that attractive. And in some way, it also relates to, you know, video gaming today and the culture of video gaming and the way in which, you know, when adolescents and young people are playing these shooter games, right, they're also texting with each other. Right, and I'm not sure that this wouldn't feel, I don't know, resonant in some way to their daily experiences, and maybe something that they would actually be attracted by. Believe it or not, I mean, I'm horrified by that. I'm not saying this with it is horrifying, and particularly horrifying that at the same time, right, the United States, the Defense Department has disbanded its unit in charge of reducing civilian casualties,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, and so, but I don't know how this is playing in the public imagination. I certainly think it's a case of immunity and impunity, and that there aren't going to be consequences. I mean, the Republicans are dismissing all of this, right?
There's a term that's used a lot in politics on both sides of the Atlantic, which is to be transgressive. And you know, the emojis also play into that, Raina, which is this idea, and right now we're having lots of talks in Brussels and Paris about how there's too much paperwork and all these rules. It's, you know, let's be transgressive. Let's just do it.
Yeah, it's a. I remember when I was listening to you two, I remember Trump said something during this odious visit that Zelensky had at the White House. You know, when they were bullying him into a corner, he said that makes for great television, and I think and I'm curious to see as a follow up of what we're talking about here, how this will play out in the days to come and how this will be mobilized to say, here, we're moving fast and breaking things.
Are the hearings in Congress great television?
Oh, no.
No, they're not great. But just to say one thing, you know, I mean, I agree with your analysis there that it's likely that a significant part of the U.S. population will say, yeah, go, man. But this was not intended to be public. Mm-hmm. It wasn't supposed to go public. So those, this was for between them, the emojis, the this, the that, you know, they're like kids, right, in that way, playing with bombs, kids playing with bombs. But it was supposed mm-hmm. to be an internal process. It's gone public, and it may have the effects that you said. Maybe not. I would hope not. But yeah, probably they will have some of those effects. I think that they're going to try to transform it
right.
into a success. By mobilizing Iran and saying, look, there's no damage done and we have succeeded and we're very forceful and we're powerful and the United States, we're demonstrating American power. They're not the first administration, of course, that has demonstrated power through bombing. There's a long history of this during the Cold War and prior to that.
And post. The Trump administration, transgressive and also, you know, testing the limits, fixing for a fight with the judiciary. For instance, ignoring a federal judge's order to halt the deportation of a plane load of more than 200 alleged members of the Venezuelan Tren del Aruga criminal gang to El Salvador. The U.S. authorities said the plane was already in international territory before takeoff. It was too late to respect the judge's order. 10 days on, the administration's not blinking. It continues to defy calls for more information from Judge James Boasberg, invoking the wartime Alien Enemies Act of 1798.
This is a time of war because Biden allowed millions of people, many of them criminals, many of them at the highest level. They emptied jails out. Other nations emptied their jails into the United States. That's an invasion. And these are criminals, many, many criminals, murderers, drug dealers at the highest level, drug lords, people from mental institutions. That's an invasion. They invaded our country.
Invading our country, it is a time of war. Does that hold up in court?
Unlikely to hold up in court. Unlikely to hold up in court. You know, that Enemies Alien Act from 1798, right, has only really been used during actual wartime, World War I, World War II, and then the Spanish War before that. And the idea that there would be some kind of it does talk about invasion, it does talk about wartime and invasion, but the idea that this would be an invasion is kind of beyond. It almost doesn't pass the
And by the way, there was kind of an emoji moment with this one as well, with El Salvador's pro-Trump president commenting on right. social Oops. Media, "Oops, too late," right, right, when the plane right, had already come
right,
his way.
Right, right, right. And what's also fascinating is compared to what we were just talking about, right, they're claiming state secrets for when the planes took off. These are commercial chartered planes with people that are being deported. And they're claiming state secrets that they can't give the information to Boasberg.
They were followed on Flight Tracker.
Right. I mean, yes. I mean, it's right. The claim of state secrets could not fly either. However, right, and this is where, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, his own little tweet and his own little emoji is a little bit worrisome.
Let's show the tweet, and then you'll tell me why it's worrisome. Okay. Afterwards, Donald Trump called for the impeachment of that judge. Then John Roberts intervening, issuing a rare statement. He doesn't usually put out statements like that, saying, quote, "Impeachment is not an appropriate response to a disagreement concerning a judicial decision."
Right. You're missing the next sentence in there that says, "The proper way to do it is to appeal."
Right.
Right? And who's it going to go to on the appeal? It's going to go to the chief judge in the United States Supreme Court. So basically, I mean, there was a mixed message.
So what? Send it my way and I'll fix it?
Send it my way. And that's how I read it. Send it my way and I'm going to fix it. They got the court.
I'll handle it.
Yeah.
Not necessarily fix it, but I'll handle it. But there was something, because we were talking about the strength of, like, what images say, right? And I don't know whether you've seen that there was a photo report in Time, I think, with absolutely horrifying images of the arrival of those prisoners. And what you see there is this fist bump and this sort of obscene, realistic, you know, projection of masculine power, and none of that image is a stolen image. Like, the photographer took the images because they were welcome to do so. So there is also that sort of staging of power, you know, like, we'll show you what we can do, and you're not happy with it, so what? You know, sort of situation where you see there was one with one of the guards, like a huge, like a boo person, you know, with just a bunch of chains on his shoulder, waiting for the prisoners to, you know, to get down, you know, to get off the plane. Mm-hmm. And they were like, and so that sort of imagery is also why I was saying earlier, let's see how those leaked chats will play out in the next days.
And the pressure is being put, you know, not just on this one judge. We had the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, on Tuesday suggesting that Congress has the power to eliminate entire federal circuit courts.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we try to interpret this from the standpoint of what we're assuming some kind of rationality. By rationality, I mean that there's a thought process behind all of this. There's a purposefulness to what is being done. a systematic effort. This is Project 2025. There's a systematic effort that's underway. It seems erratic. It is erratic in many ways. It seems incoherent in some respects because of the nature, the erratic character.
So which is it, Philip Golub? So is it a political project, or is it, as you were saying earlier, about the ratings?
It's a political project. You are a professor of law. It's a political project that is designed to create unlimited, unchecked power in the executive, to create undiluted executive authority. I think it's not for nothing that a lot of people today are actually coming back to the Nazi jurist Carl Schmitt and talking about the influence that his work is having in some of these circles. C.D. Vance himself refers to Schmitt and Schmitt's idea of a Caesarist dictatorship, a sovereign dictatorship. That's the term that Schmitt uses. There's a coherent effort here to dislodge the judiciary and to get rid of the separation.
How does that differ?
To create unchecked executive power.
Philip Golub, how does that differ from 2017 when France's president on the campaign trail promised a Jupiterian presidency, that he would be a strong president?
Yes, well, that's, Emmanuel Macron did announce, I think, showing a great degree of megalomania at the time, that comparing himself to Jupiter, he wanted a Jupiterian presidency. The French Constitution, Fifth Republic Constitution, differs from the American Constitution. The separation of powers, the balance in the separation of powers is really quite different. The Constitutional Court in France doesn't have the same powers as the Supreme Court used to have in the United States, in any case. And the Senate in France has none of the powers that the U.S. Senate has. So emasculating, if that's the right word here, I'm not quite sure it is, but emasculating the judiciary in the United States, attacking it frontally, and at the same time, making Congress completely impotent, is part of an effort to concentrate power. The Supreme Court, in its decision in July, basically gave Trump the means by which to do this without facing any legal consequences. And all further presidents going forward will have increasingly limitless power.
So Bernard Harcourt, is the executive branch of government now have outsized powers compared to the judiciary and the legislative, or is the jury still out?
Well, the jury is still out in the sense that, I mean, there's been a two decades long effort to create a unified executive, to create a very powerful executive. It was happening under George W. Bush. It was happening under even Obama. And the same scholars who were advocating for what was called a unified executive with kind of imperial powers, they were arguing for it actually when Obama was president as well. They didn't flip back and say, you know, oh, no. No, they kept on going. These are folks, Adrian Vermeule at Harvard, others who have had this idea of creating a really strong unified power, which they're speaking about now in kind of imperial terms. Now, game isn't over yet, because the reason that the other branches aren't doing anything right now is because they're controlled by the Republican Party, right? I mean, so Congress isn't doing anything because they're controlled by the Republican power. If Congress were in Democratic hands, I think the situation would look very different. I think that they would be passing, either bills or declarations trying to annul the executive orders. They would be having hearings for every executive order. I mean, they would be putting as much pressure as they could.
But it's a long time till there. It's a long time till
it's
the
two
midterms.
Years. Yeah, it's 2 years, right?
And just let me say one thing: they're actually destroying things. They're destroying the administrative state very efficiently, very quickly. That can't be rebuilt.
And judges can't keep up.
The destruction of the administrative state was part of the fascist playbook. It must be said. It was part of the fascist playbook in Italy and in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's very interesting because we had such, let me be polite and, behave here.
Be polite.
Illiberal tendencies, for example, in Poland, right, under the previous ruling party. And what happened in Poland is they tried, it was death by 1,000 cuts, by starting to remove judges and replace them with political nominees, right? So you have two ways of dismantling the rule of law in general. Either you do it slowly, with time, death by a thousand cuts. But that means you're extremely laser-focused on where the checks and balances are and you go for the jugular, which is the judiciary. That happened in Poland. Or you do whatever we are seeing now, where it's all-inclusive, you know, with...
Everything all at once.
Everything all at once. Mm. That's why it looks erratic. And also because there are absolutely devastating things where, for example, there was this question from a judge, I don't remember the name, but who, like, what's the role of Elon Musk and who is the actual head of Dodge, you know, the department of so-called Department of Government Efficiency. And the person who was asked, you know, from the executive side of things to respond to that question, refused to respond and spent days before naming a name, right? And so, and that's what we are seeing also in the hearings today, right? So when people tell you it's not classified information, what's our recourse there? Our recourse is from a legal scholar, from, you know, people who care about the rules. We would go and we would look at procedures and how things are defined and da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, but do they really care about this? And even if it were a protocol break, so what? What are you going to do about it? You go to the judiciary and then the judiciary is taking the time it takes until it goes to the Supreme Court where... things may not, you know, pan out well for
well,
you.
Well, let's talk about a concrete example, which is where you teach. Columbia University made news last spring with the occupation of the main New York City campus by pro-Palestinian demonstrators, retribution coming with the threat of suspension of $400 million in federal funding. Now, to save its endowment, the university has since agreed to empower security officers to arrest people and reassigned control of the Middle East Studies Department, while students have successfully sued to block the immediate deportation of foreign students. They include a prominent Palestinian student activist, Mahmoud Khalil, and even a Korean-born resident who's been a permanent resident in the U.S. since she was 7 years old.
Today, Yoon Se-yeol-chung no longer has to fear and live in fear of ICE coming to her doorstep and abducting her in the night, as they did Mr. Khalil and other student activists in this country. And so pending further of the court, the administration will not be able to do that. We will, of course, continue to press her claims in court. Our position is that the only reason that the government is seeking to detain a 21-year-old college junior at Columbia, a high school valedictorian with no criminal priors, is simply because her viewpoint, her speech, her First Amendment protected speech, it happens to be something that they disagree with.
Ben Arcourt, do people at Columbia see this as a win? The judicial system is held. They've blocked her from being deported for now, or do they see this as basically a loss?
Well, I mean, on her particular case, it's a win, and I mean, it's a legal, it's a short.
So the system still works in the United States.
You know, I mean, you have to understand that actually, in terms of the prior conversation, I mean, the only check that there is right now are the lower federal courts, you know, not only in this case, but also on all of the other challenges to the executive orders. I mean, that's the only existing check right now, and it's still relatively holding up. The question is whether there's going to be the constitutional crisis that we all anticipate, where at some point the Trump administration and Vance are simply going to say, look, you know, you ruled, now try and enforce it. We're not going to listen to what you're doing. At this now, and of course, that's what came up with the Venezuelan case. But there's ongoing litigation in Mr. Khalil's case as well. He's right now in a detention center, a horrible detention center in Yena, Louisiana. But, I mean, his case is being reviewed. I mean, the basis for that deportation is really flimsy. There, it's a section of the Immigration Naturalization Act that actually gives the Secretary of State the power to deport anyone who they reasonably believe is going to be adverse to United States foreign policy interests, right? And actually, that was struck down by Trump's sister, who was a federal judge.
A long time ago.
In 97. Trump's sister was a very well-respected federal district court judge, and she struck that statute down, the specific one that they're using now, saying it was too vague and it gave too much discretion to the Secretary General. It was kind of like it was arbitrary.
So it's not a given through U.S. history that the power of the executive always grows. Sometimes that power is reined in. At Columbia right now, what's the mood?
Well, there's a lot of shock among the faculty. There's an enormous amount of fear among students and international students. Real fear. I mean, tangible people, international students will come to me in the hallway and talk to me about their fears and their concerns. It's unprecedented. Now, and it's the perfect example. You were talking about the demolition that's going on right now. This is the demolition phase of the counter-revolution, but it's taking on trying to demolish Columbia University as an elite university that produces people who tend to vote blue, right? This is a decades-long effort to go after higher education.
How is this different from chasing out of communists after World War I and World War II, the McCarthy era?
That's the parallel. I think that's the strongest parallel for the moment right now is the McCarthy era. I mean, it's possibly in some dimensions going to get worse. There's a federal investigation. There's a task force that just came out with a federal investigation for federal prosecutions, clearly targeting students who've protested, and those are for anti-terrorism laws. Those are significant, lengthy sentences, potential sentences. And really what it turns on is whether the protesters have, in a way, used a language that is similar to the propaganda that is coming out of a terrorist organization
like Hamas. Is this an ideology, as Philip Golub was arguing, or is this just simply retribution because I'm aggrieved by you contradicting me?
Well, it's a little bit. It's both, right? It's a little bit of both. I think you have to think about it long term. It's been a Republican strategy to go after elite universities for decades. Mm-hmm. Okay, and now they've got the perfect kind of constellation of factors coming into place. They're using the question of anti-Semitism as the vehicle here, and their attack on DEI, and they're doing it very powerfully. And the strategy again is to go after one entity, one institution at a time, and they're doing it very well. It's the same thing that they're doing with Paul Weiss, right? They go after one.
This is big law firms in Washington.
Big law firms, but the idea is you go after one entity, and then the others will not kind of come in. The others are freaked out, scared. They don't want to stick their necks out. Yeah. But you can really kind of strangle one entity like Columbia or like Paul Weiss.
It's the bloody example. It's what the Chinese saying. You cut off the head of the chicken to scare all the monkeys. So, and everybody is scared. I don't teach at Columbia, and I'm not in the U.S. right now, but all my friends there tell me that it's absolutely atrocious. So they just arrested ICE just arrested a student, a graduate student at Tufts. They didn't arrest him. They abducted him, actually, in the same way as they did with Khalil. The difference with McCarthyism, I think, is this. I think McCarthyism is indeed the appropriate historical analogy. The difference is the following. Eisenhower let McCarthy do, some of the things that he did for a while, and then when McCarthy went too far, Eisenhower and other Republicans actually stopped him. There was opposition from within, and Eisenhower.
And McCarthy, remind our viewers, was a senator, not the president.
He was senator, and his lead prosecutor was called Roy Cohn, who happens to be the person who actually built Trump into a political figure in the first place. Roy Cohn, absolutely horrific figure, vindictive, crazy anti-communist. No, but the point is, you don't have that today. The Republican Party is aligned behind Trump. The president is not going to contain what he himself has started. So in that sense, it's worse.
Right. Yeah.
Rina Stambouli, why is it that this is happening at this moment in time? Is this something unprecedented? We're back to this concept, which I think it was Mark Zuckerberg who first came up with the term move fast and break things, if I'm not mistaken, or somebody from Facebook. But why are we in a move fast and break things moment in politics in the U.S. and perhaps here in Europe?
Well, your guess is as good as mine in the sense that there are so many reasons, you know, of why we are where we are.
But there must be an overarching reason that goes above, just above individuals. And we focus too much on personalities, but it's...
So, yeah, that's true. There are different converging mechanisms that we could, you know, which are not exclusive or, they, you know, among them, and they are not comprehensive, but they kind of point towards something. You can have this idea that is very much clear now, especially with the Broligarchy coming up, you know, that since institutions are broken and people suffer, then, therefore, democracy is broken. And then there are those people nurturing this, you know, instead of having professors or intellectuals, you know, producing thought, constructive, structured thought, you have developers becoming podcasters, or this Yarvin individual who is like a techie, but he's been having this blog for years. And that's also what's nurtured that sort of situation where what we are trying to do is let's fix the system the way we want it to work, right? That's very important, because when you fix the system the way you want it to work, it doesn't mean everyone else wants it to work that way, right? But then that's where those people start to converge in that sort of magma, you know, in that sort of very loose, ideologically connected thingy, where you have people who consider that humans are imperfect. They vote to produce elected officials who are imperfect. And therefore, the system as a whole is imperfect and it's not working. However, today we have technology. You know, code works, you say it, you do this, and it does this. So how about we replace the imperfect humans and therefore the imperfect political system they have, that's called democracy. How about we replaced it with something that is making optimized decisions, especially at this to Trump's very clear stance that resources are finite, and the U.S. have been giving so much to others, this freeloaders thing in the chats, about Europe, that now enough is enough. We've given you enough. It's not working. So what we're going to do is we're going to fix the thing, cut red tape, whatever, you know, thing you have it. And we're going to do our own thing and you deal with whatever's left. And which leaves Europe as the only, if you like, liberal actor in a post-liberal world, right?
But, and I think this goes back to your question, which was, you know, perhaps here in Europe. I mean, the fact is, there are these tendencies in Europe as well, right? And we're seeing them creeping up everywhere with the, AfD in Italy, with Meloni,
etc. Well, we're seeing evidence in both directions, right? Because on the one hand, as you're right, the rise of the far right in many countries, but we have demonstrators out in the streets in places like Serbia and Turkey right now,
right,
where they've had illiberal regimes for a long time.
Right. But I think the point is that we can't focus too much, as you were suggesting, on the personality of Donald Trump, right? Because there are too many of these personalities across the world. And we have to figure out what it is exactly that are the forces that somehow, you know, the social conflicts that are fueling these, you know, autocrats.
Yeah, really. The sociological reasons behind the transformations. Trump was not an accident. If he had been an accident, you can't be an aberration twice. So he may have been a symptom. He was a symptom of something deeper, and he, having been elected twice now, the symptom became a cause. The symptom has transformed itself into an active cause of the transformation that he was a symptom of in the first place. And that's true of some of these other leaders too. But given the outsized influence of the United States worldwide, it has global impacts, which it doesn't have if Orban alone was doing this on his side. I think there's a real question about the techno-dystopians. And some of them are techno-fascists of Silicon Valley. Not all Silicon Valley is techno-fascist. But there's a real question about this: how this specific grouping of people, Peter Thiel, Sachs, David Sachs, Musk himself, obviously, there are many more than he, Andreessen with his...
Yeah, so a concentration of power in very few hands.
Yeah, concentration of enormous economic power and technological power. And, you know, when Bernie Sanders says oligarchy, you know, that for me that resonates, okay? That resonates. A certain kind of oligarchical network that's actually emerged there, all right? And how that fits into Trumpism, to me, the only plausible explanation there is they serve Trump's interest in the concentration of power, and he serves them.
Just on one last point,
for the privatization of essential functions, right, which they think is essential to their own agenda.
Which, in the prolongation, I'm giving you back the. Right. In the prolongation of this whole, let's fix, you know, the system, you have people who are quite structured, such as Peter Thiel,
who have an interest in privatizing everything.
Who is the most structured of them all? Who has been ideologizing for years now that you should run a country the way a CEO runs a company. Mm. And so you get this, and when you see the conflicts of interests between federal, like them as federal contractors and them as participants to the rulemaking, but you are like jumping with 2 feet into the whole thing.
So we have a concentration of power, but right, Bernard Arcourt,
right,
it's also an age of transparency, and that leaked chat on Signal is perhaps an illustration of that. It's an age of transparency where everything's sticky, everything is known. In that respect, this concentration of power, is it tenable politically after a while if enough people suffer?
Yeah, well, it's hard because there's also this conflict with the Trump base, right? I mean, because these are very different. I mean, right now they're working together, but right now they're on the same team, as it were. But these are people who think very differently than the tech oligarchs. You know, I mean, the Steve Bannons of the world say, soak the rich. Steve Bannon says, soak the rich all the time, right? And you see the conflict between Bannon and Musk, et cetera. So, I mean, those are enormous conflicts. And I think, you know, the fact that there is this transparency is probably going to give us a better view into those conflicts.
Just a parenthesis, it wasn't transparent. It wasn't leaked. They made the mistake of hooking in the Atlantic, okay? So right. It wasn't a leak.
Right, that's true. That was also my point. Like, you have the two of them. You have an information overload on one side, and on the other side, you also have a challenge to creating a shared reality. And that's also why someone like Musk is attacking Wikipedia, which comes out as a completely ludicrous thing, right? However, think about it. What is the shared reality source that we have today? We have Wikipedia. We don't have Twitter anymore. You know what I mean? So the only space where you can go and see facts that reflect what really happened and happens in the world, it's Wikipedia. However, how do you establish a concentration of power that works in the middle? If you have somewhere where people can go and say, this is not true.
So how to reestablish a common space? That's fodder for a debate. Many thanks, Reina Stamboliska. I want to thank as well Philip Golub, Bernard Arcourt. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.